Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The gate to the kingdom is opening once more. This month sees the return of Lars von Trier's cult 90s series The Kingdom. The acclaimed filmmaker behind Antichrist, Melancholia and Nymphomaniac is picking up where he left off with The Kingdom Exodus, a brand new limited series available exclusively on Mubi from November 27th. A continuation, reboot, and revival of the original series, The Kingdom Exodus is a disturbing, darkly funny blend of supernatural ghost story and workplace sitcom, with von Trier's signature anarchic streak once again at the fore. If you're new to The Kingdom, Mubi has you covered. Newly restored versions of The Kingdom 1 and 2 are streaming on the platform from November 13th and 20th. Episode 1 of The Kingdom Exodus is released a week later on November 27th, with new episodes dropping weekly on Mubi right up until December 25th. Consider it an early gift from your friend and ours, Lars von Trier. Head to Mubi.com to start streaming. Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Hannah Strong.
On the show this week, Noah Baumbach and some of his favourites reunite for White Noise. David Lynch's passions are explored in Lynch/Oz. And on Film Club, the film that Michael Caine should have won an Oscar for, The Muppets Christmas Carol. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. David, Hannah, welcome back. I do always feel a bit strange welcoming you to this because I feel like this is ultimately, you are the authority figure here. So it's sort of, I'm not sure what the power dynamic is now.
Oh, you know, obviously preferred to have other people on and a more sort of rich and diverse array of voices. But at the same time, you know, I want to muscle in. I want to have a chance on the old soapbox.
Yeah, well, we've got you on a lot in the next coming weeks. We've got some cool Christmas specials coming up. We've got end of the year to kind of look back on together, which will be fun. Avatar 2. But yeah, is there anything else that you're kind of cooking up in this festive period?
Not really. I think in terms of like Christmas movies, I know this is a bit of a cop out, but like I'm actually catching up with a lot of the festival things that I missed from the autumn season, because I didn't get to go to Venice this year or Toronto, and then during the London Film Festival we had a big magazine deadline, so I'm now sort of like hoovering up things that I wasn't able to catch when they first played, and that's really cutting into my the time that I would otherwise give to watching Christmas themed movies. The one that I'm actually most excited about, my wife and I have got it, like we've said, as soon as December 1 hits, which will have hit by the time you listen to this podcast, that we're going to watch the Lindsay Lohan one. I can't even remember what it's called, but it's like the Netflix Lindsay Lohan one where she does a dual role. Classic.
Yeah, I think it is sort of almost like the final boss of Netflix Christmas films, this Lindsay Lohan one. It's I don't want to spoil too much of it, but it's basically Overboard, but in Aspen.
Oh, I'm already sold. Yeah, I'm well up for that. So have you seen it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, I do not play by the rules. I will start my Christmas movies in November. No issue.
Yeah, no.
And Hannah, what about you? What have you been up to?
You know, not much. I just turned 30 for anyone listening. So, you know, that was a big deal.
Tell him about your swag.
Oh, yeah. No, we're in the midst of, it's that time of the year when awards voting starts. So the studios are pretty aggressively campaigning to critics at the moment. It will end very soon and they'll move on to the guilds and start courting their favour. But at the moment at Little White Lies headquarters, on any given day, about four parcels will arrive for me, full of miscellaneous kind of film merchandise that they just send you because they want you to vote for their film. It's really weird. I've never done it before. Well, I've done voting before, but I've never been sent all the stuff. So it's been very interesting. And you do kind of feel a bit like, you know, you're being taken out for a nice meal by someone trying to curry your favor. Only it's much more low rent than that. It's just a lot of t-shirts and hats and the occasional bag of sweets. So that's kind of mainly where I'm at, trying to figure out where I'm going to put it all in my flat, or, you know, who I can kind of give it to.
But you guys are just a few days away from the print deadline on the next issue. So, I mean, I'm surprised you both look very fresh face considered, but how's that all going?
Well, yeah, no, it's going well. The next issue goes to press just before Christmas. So we're kind of beavering away at the moment. In fact, Hannah's off on a special secret mission tomorrow that requires her to be up very early doors, that is for our next issue, so that should be a fun one. One other thing to mention, bringing in all the chat of Christmas and magazines, we're launching a little thing on Monday through our social channels where essentially if you subscribe to the issue, and, you know, I would obviously heartily suggest that you should, as a lovely Christmas gift for your cinephile in-law / Bezzy mate, they're coming with a free cover print. So like you get a little free gift for if you pick up a subscription pre-Christmas.
Yeah, for the person who has everything, exactly, for the indeed. Film fan in your life. But we should get a move on with this week's films. First up, White Noise. Jack Gladney is a professor of Hitler studies at the College on the Hill, husband to Babette and father to four children. Things are thrown into disarray by a cataclysmic train accident that casts chemical waste over his town and is labelled the airborne toxic event. So Hannah, you and I saw this together a little while ago. It was the film that opened Venice. What did you think about it then, and has your kind of feelings about it changed in the months since?
Yeah, I was very excited to learn that it would be opening Venice, because it's a film that's kind of been on my radar for quite a long time. I was very curious about how Baumbach would tackle Don DeLillo. It doesn't really feel like a natural pairing to me. DeLillo's prose is very dense and quite complex, and a lot of very long diatribes that kind of go off in all these different directions. And I think that Baumbach's filmmaking is quite straightforward in a lot of ways, and a lot more domestic, I would say, than a lot of DeLillo's work. I mean, White Noise is a kind of domestic novel in some regard, but we'll get onto that in a minute. But yeah, no, I was very excited about this. I love Adam Driver, and I was very excited for the Gerwig acting return. We haven't seen her kind of do a bit of acting in a while, and I was a little bit kind of sceptical about the casting. I do think that Driver and Gerwig are a little bit young for these characters, who are supposed to kind of be in their 50s, maybe late 40s, but I was very taken with it. I think it's a much more successful adaptation than I maybe expected it to be. But I feel like I'm dunking on Baumbach here, which is not the case. I just think that I really was kind of a bit nervous, and I wasn't a huge fan of Marriage Story, so I was kind of on the back foot with him anyway. And I recently watched Kicking and Screaming for the first time, and I really like hated that film. So I was already kind of not really sure what to expect, but it kind of took me by surprise, and it appeals to so many things that I love. I'm a real like pessimist, and I love an end of the world apocalyptic riff, and this very much, you know, you can kind of tell it was made in the pandemic because it is so preoccupied with death, and it does center around this incident involving this massive chemical spill, and they're all wearing masks, and there's all the kind of air of panic. So I hate saying that something is timely, but it is. It's very much, you can kind of see why Baumbach might have being interested in making this film at this point in history. And yeah, I was very taken with it. It's so, it feels really different stylistically as well. It's so colourful and so kind of, he always goes for kind of realism, and this is very like hyper stylized. Everyone talks like that they're in a book, you know? They talk with this kind of cadence, which I think doesn't feel Baumbach-y, but I settled into it very like easily. And he's got such an amazing cast here, you know, obviously like Driver and Gerwig are always I don't think I've ever seen him give a bad performance, but my real like MVP is Don Cheadle. He's just so delightful in this film.
Yeah, he's got that real kind of jazzy energy where he can do that. It's almost kind of a bit Katharine Hepburn-esque, that sort of really rhythmic way with this sort of rather dense dialogue. But yeah, to me, I really like this. I think this is probably my top tier Baumbach for me. No, Scorsese always says that you should try and make films that are very personal to you, but I actually think he could do with making films like this that are a lot less personal than some of his other fare. But David, were you also coming into it like me, like having never read the novel, or did you have quite a strong sense of what Don DeLillo's novel was?
Yeah, I actually had read it in the summer this year, so before it played in Venice. And I'm a fan of his, and I've read a couple of his books anyway, so it wasn't by no means a kind of chore to do that. And obviously very happy to have picked that one up and ticked that one off the list, because it's, you know, rightly deemed to be one of his vital texts. I think it's funny when you read a book ahead of a kind of impending screenplay, I tend to envisage the actors in the role as I'm reading the book and sort of think about what scenes might look like with people and the faces of the people, the actors that's kind of there in my head. And it was weird because, like, just to give another example, in Cannes this year, Claire Denis made a film called Stars at Noon by Denise Johnson. Sorry, an adaptation of his novel, The Stars at Noon. And I read it at a time when Robert Pattinson was cast as the main role. And it was funny because I read the book with Robert Pattinson in my head. But then when the film came, it wasn't Robert Pattinson. It was Joe Alwyn. And I think that might have been one of the root causes of my disappointment in that one. But so that's a little side observation about the kind of hazards of reading novels before watching movies. But even after Venice and even after reading reviews, I was still a bit like unsure of like, what is this film? The way people are describing it and the way it seems to be kind of presenting itself is all over the map. I can't tell if it's a kind of slightly weirdo comedy or whether it does have this kind of mainstream appeal or what kind of movies it's channeling. And it's really interesting. Like, I think I saw it like a couple of days after Jean-Luc Godard died, actually, which was kind of bittersweet because it does on some level feel like an homage to his film Weekend, which is kind of like deals with this kind of, it's looking at societal breakdown and the apocalypse, but then how that is filtered through our kind of bourgeois obsessions and the way that we've kind of learned to live our life. And there's lots of focus in the film on consumerism and capitalism and how we're defined by our jobs and our roles and wanting to kind of break out of them a bit. And it did on that sense feel like, you know, I'm not sure I've read an interview where he's mentioned it, but there's no doubt that he had ingested the sort of spirit of Weekend while making this film. But then at the same time, it really is through and through got this kind of American goofiness to it, which I think is just very charming. And on some levels, it plays like a kind of Chevy Chase National Lampoon's film where you've got all this kind of breakdown happening and the family unit are reacting to it in this way that is very kind of sealed off. And they even have their big kind of walnut dash paneled car that they drive around in, which has got that kind of vacation vibe to it. And I find it really funny, actually. I don't know if it's just me in my sort of dotage getting very kind of jaded and cynical, but like, it's hard to think of a film this year that I've laughed at more. I mean, just some of the line deliveries and some of the kind of comic set pieces, they're just done in a way that you kind of get a sense of like, yeah, Baumbach knows his business. He knows how to edit these things and how to write them and how to direct them as well. And yeah, I mean, final thing I would say, echoing Hannah, it's a very different type of film for Noah Baumbach. He's someone who is like, you'd kind of ally with the Bergmans and the Woody Allens and people who do this quite sort of like quite intellectually inclined psychoanalytic films about psychological studies and relationships and analyzing how people interact with one another. And this is very different. This is more like, you know, again, I'm throwing in references here, but there is a kind of like early Spielberg vibe to the whole thing. And that's something that has been mentioned quite a lot, that it does have this kind of, in the same way that Spielberg's early films are, and indeed his new one, The Fabelmans, are all about like kind of dissolution of the family unit. And then the dissolution and then the kind of reconstruction of the family unit in a different form. This also sort of takes that structure as well. And I think that Baumbach has almost like, he sort of acknowledged that and has stylistically given us quite a sort of Spielberg-y film in the way that he directs certain like scenes of like family interactions and family life. It's very, you know, lots of like overlapping dialogue. It's very kind of Spielberg-y.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of things all at once, to the point where I think sometimes when you talk about it, it sounds like you are talking about a made up film. Where, you know, there's all this existential dread and questions around what the commitment of marriage really means, and death and apocalypse, and then, you know, Hitler's mum versus Elvis's mum as a sort of academic rap battle, musical numbers. Hannah, for you, did that sort of like quite a lot of vacillation in kind of tonal shift work for you?
Yeah, I think it surprised me how well it worked, especially because I don't think of Baumbach as being someone who really plays the genre that much. I mean, we had the company scene in A Marriage Story, which is like my highlight of that film. So I think that's maybe an example of him kind of trying something a little bit different, because that obviously feels like such a stagey moment in an otherwise very kind of like realistic Scenes from a Marriage style kind of breakdown. So I was actually like quite, you know, excited to see him do something a bit different. The whole kind of like third act or a good portion of the third act is almost like a kind of, there's like a horror edge to it. It's in this very dank apartment that's kind of green, and there's this confrontation between Adam Driver and this mysterious character who's kind of the MacGuffin who they've been kind of trying to like find. I mean, I guess it's, you know, when you're working from really good source material, it's almost easier in a way. But I think that Baumbach was kind of, you know, he had a bit of an uphill battle with this one because the novel is so dense and there are things that he had to cut out. But it does gel in a way that I found very satisfying and very interesting. I don't think you can be bored watching this film. I think it's got a real kind of like pace to it, which I enjoyed. And it moves from the kind of world of academia to this suddenly life-changing cataclysmic event and then back again in a way that I found like not only like satisfying, but quite novel. Because I think with these kind of, you know, end of the world movies, we get very used to the rhythm of like, here is life before, here is life during, and here is life after. Oh my God, it's so different. But what this film is suggesting is, oh, maybe the world just carries on after everything goes wrong. You know, I think it's actually kind of has more to say about the world we live in than a lot of kind of the films that have tried to do pandemic cinema. I think this idea of death and these big kind of natural changes is something quite banal, is like scary in its own way, and I appreciated, you know, that so the kind of acknowledgement this film has of like how mundanity is both comforting and terrifying in its own way. And I mean, fundamentally it's a love story, and these two central characters love each other so much, and their whole thing is, I don't want to die before you, I'm so scared I'm going to die before you. And I just thought that was very romantic. And yeah, I mean, I would walk to the ends of the earth for Driver and Gerwig. I think they have such an amazing screen presence together. And Baumbach really, like, I know some people take issue with directors who keep working with the same actors, but I think they have such a kind of like strong chemistry as a little trio. I don't really see why they would want to work with anyone else.
So David, we should probably get some scores on this in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect.
Yeah, I would probably say like 4-5-4. Because, yeah, my anticipation was quite high. All the kind of elements suggested that this was going to be at the very least interesting. I had a really good time watching this film, and I think as Hannah says, it's got this slightly more, I guess, somber third act that is purposely more downbeat than the opening. I think that if you accept it for what it is and look at what it's exploring, I actually think that some of the best material in the film is in the sort of the final stretch, particularly one incredible sequence, which is like one of my favorite scenes of the year, in which it's essentially a kind of extended two-way dialogue scene between Gerwig and Driver in a bedroom, where she's kind of, you know, that there are some sort of major revelations about their lives that they kind of admit to one another, and the way that she kind of spills the beans and the way that he reacts to it, is it feels very authentic. That's maybe a bit of a cryptic description, but I'm trying not to spoil here. So I'm really excited to see this one again. I think the 4 in retrospect is maybe because there is a lot to chew on, and I'm not sure like it does feel like there's like material for like two or three normal films in there.
Hannah, what about you? Was it a case of you hated the film, but then you got the swag and then you have been successfully bribed? I don't know that we can trust you, but what are your scores?
No, I luckily I have the evidence in that my Venice review was very positive. So I've always been on board with this one. It's fours across the board for me. I rewatched it the other evening and it's still delightful. Have to give a shout out to the end credit sequence, which I think is probably the best end credit sequence of the year. I won't spoil it for anyone that hasn't seen the film yet, but it's just a really delightful moment and everyone in the cast is kind of clearly like having a really good time, a very unbound back end sequence, and has a new LCD sound system song, which is like an absolute bop. And if that won Best Original Song at the Oscars, I would be just kind of over the moon. So very much enjoyed it and very glad to see Don Cheadle getting to do like some good comedy again. I'm always just so happy when he gets to flex that muscle because he's such an amazing comic actor.
Yeah, I have to agree that end sequence is amazing. I think lots of people seem to find it really fun. I was in floods of tears with that end sequence. But yeah, no, it really worked for me. I think probably falls across the board as well. I'm sort of, I've got an intense fear of death. I think about it all the time. I have a marriage that I'm very attached to. So I think like, I love this whole central concept of sort of that you're sort of existentially tying yourself to a partner's mortality with that union. I was really, really pleasantly surprised because like you, Hannah, I wasn't a huge fan of Marriage Story, but this was just great fun and it wasn't dumb fun. Next up, Vinch Oz. Victor Fleming's film, The Wizard of Oz, is one of David Lynch's most enduring obsessions. This documentary goes over the rainbow to explore the technicolor through line in Lynch's work. So David, famously, it is pretty pointless as an exercise to ask David Lynch a question about his work. So we do have to do quite a lot of guessing as to what his intentions are. Do you think this sort of works as getting under the hood of all of the symbolism and weirdness in his films?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny that you think that conceptually this film is maybe built on like the sand foundations, because although he does allude to it in interviews and, you know, they've done it, there's a bit of detective work that they do where they find a picture of his studio where he's got like a glossy black and white photo of Dorothy on the wall, and there are lots of, you know, they've dug out like direct references to Wizard of Oz in his movies, so that basically taking a punt on this and saying, yeah, we think there's enough there to go on, but that he's never just said outright this is a major influence on my film and that all these references are, you know, the key to unlocking what I do. But what this film is essentially is, I think you'd describe it as an essay film, which is a kind of form that's quite prevalent online. Usually you kind of see these things on YouTube. And in fact, Little White Lies produce many of them on our YouTube channel if you wanted to go and see them. But yeah, and these things are a kind of visual opportunity to explore elements of pressing themes or obsessions or little things we notice about a filmmaker. And they often support kind of, I guess, what you would call like auteurist readings, where you have visual references that link films together or present a kind of through line of this is what makes this director, because they keep doing this or they keep referencing this or they keep using this motif. What this film has done is it's kind of gathered up a bunch of people, some filmmakers, some critics. They get to narrate their own little kind of mini chapter about 10-15 minutes that focuses, I want to say, on different aspects of this relationship between David Lynch and The Wizard of Oz, but there's not really any specific delineation between the six. It's more just like personal takes, and some of them are interesting. Like as a film, I don't think it really works at all. Like I think that some have understood the brief and some definitely haven't, but that doesn't necessarily preclude it from not being entertaining. Like for instance, like there's a whole section from John Waters which is really fascinating on his own relationship to Wizard of Oz and his own and how his films and Lynch's films cross over and his relationship to Lynch, but doesn't necessarily give much on Lynch and Oz and how that overlaps. There are some kind of more academic ones. There's like the critic Amy Nicholson has a section at the beginning called Wind, where she's sort of looking at the sort of atmospheric crossover between Lynch and Wizard of Oz, and it's interesting but maybe a little bit dry. My two standouts were MVP by a long shot for me was the filmmaker Karen Kusama, who is just really like laser focused on the brief. She just delivers lots of really sharp insights, very articulately expressed. It really, really opens out this relationship and really keys into what it is about, what the meaning of this crossover is. And I also think the other really good one is by filmmaker David Lowery, who kind of closes things out. His is maybe a little bit more kind of all over the place. I think it's quite charming, and there's definitely an attempt to focus on the brief. Inevitably, he brings in his own films and readings as well, and how essentially moves into it, to this idea of like, well, all filmmakers are influenced by something in some kind of subconscious way, which is a bit of a sort of like stating the obvious in the end, even though it's nice to see that represented visually. But yeah, it's a strange film. I don't think it necessarily needed to be more than like a 15-minute film all in to really state what it needed to state. But I didn't have a bad time watching it.
Yeah, I think you had a more sustained energy than I did having it, because I definitely liked Amy Nicholson's the best, but I think that was just because it came first and I just became, you know, kind of increasingly tired of it. But Hannah, what about you? Did any like great moments or segments stand out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult. Just generally, documentaries about filmmakers are difficult because most of the time the subject is more interesting than the documentary itself. And especially with essay films, I think it's even harder because there is like, I do wonder why this got to be a film and it wasn't just kind of on YouTube or something. I guess it's, you know, it's because of the high profile talent involved. It's interesting. It's a very interesting subject. I love David Lynch. So, you know, I did enjoy kind of all these like clips of him just like refusing to kind of talk about his work that were very funny. There's a great clip of him talking to Mark Kermode, and Mark Kermode's like, oh, am I in the ballpark? And he's like, no. Which I very much enjoyed. So that was fun. I very much enjoyed the John Waters section and then the David Lowery section. I think because the David Lowery section really like speaks to kind of a wider truth about filmmaking. He says that all filmmakers are essentially making the same film over and over, and the way to understand their filmmaking is to understand the thing that they're obsessed with. And it's not that David Lynch is obsessed with The Wizard of Oz. It's more that he's obsessed with the kind of things that are in The Wizard of Oz, if that makes sense. So this idea of home, this idea of parallel realities, which are all kind of subjects that do come up in the various chapters of Lynch Oz. And I think that's a really like interesting way of looking at filmmaking, and particularly looking at like auteurs. Lowery brings up Spielberg, and he brings up like his connection to Spielberg's work and how he's been kind of like sneaking in little references to Spielberg his whole life. And that to me, like, I hadn't really thought about filmmaking as like looking for the clues that let us understand a whole filmmaker's filmography and what kind of higher truths they're trying to grasp at. I think is like quite a fun one and might change the way I kind of think about films when I'm watching them in future. The thing that I'm very preoccupied with is that I wasn't expecting to see clips from Back to the Future as much as I saw them in this film. Like there are so many mentions of Back to the Future here. And then there's like they mention it and be like, oh, it's not a very Lynchian film. Well, why are you mentioning it then? Like if it's, there's a lot of kind of like just little diatribes where I was like, this film is nearly 2 hours and I don't think it needs to be quite as long as it is. I think there's definitely ways they could have made it a little bit more succinct, which I might have ended up with, you know, kind of different length video essays, which kind of might have felt a bit disjointed. Yeah, there's just a few kind of bits where I was like, oh, I think the kind of narrator or the writers of these essays are being a little bit self-indulgent. And I will say as well, which is not a spoiler, but this is now the second film I have seen this year which has a clip from Avatar in it when I wasn't expecting a clip from Avatar to be in there. So like, what is going on? Like, who is James Cameron paying? Like, I don't understand how Avatar 2 will be the third time I've seen Avatar in some capacity on a screen this year.
Wow, the things we do for our work. But yeah, I mean, I think there is like a strangeness to kind of having a podcast where we're talking about films or writing about films and this stuff with a film like this, it just feels like we've gotten to the point of dancing about architecture, because it's like there's the Wizard of Oz and then there's the David Lynch's view of it. And then it's these people and their opinion of it. And now we're talking about that. And I feel so far removed from like substance at this point. I didn't not enjoy it. I just kind of felt like I didn't understand really what the point of its existence was.
I think that about a lot of video essays.
I mean, it was definitely enjoyable to like, even though I'm very familiar with his films and work, just seeing the clips again in good quality and seeing the kind of love for like, you know, the eighth episode of Twin Peaks: The Return. And that was really nice. I'd say one thing that upset me though, is, which was very strange considering what short shrift the straight story get, like barely any mention in the film. And it's like, guys, it's a guy in a kind of possible death haze going on a journey down a road on a lawnmower. It's like
Lowry talks about that quite a lot.
He talks about it a tiny bit, but you know, it's really skipped over. I mean, they really focus on like the idea of talking about Lynch. You have to acknowledge the idea of him sort of skipping between these kind of dream states and realities. And the joy of his films is that he's not telling you, you know, which is the dream, which is the reality, which is the projection, and which is the fantasy. So you know, like it's just his films are so exciting because it's the game of trying to guess where you are. But then at the same time, it, you know, the film really hammers that home, and maybe without kind of looking at some further aspects of things like straight story. I just think the straight story erasure is unacceptable.
I was surprised how little they talk about Eraserhead as well, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that's the film that, for me, that he's talked the most about as well in terms of like what his intentions were and how he made it. So like he's been the most open about it. I mean, I guess it's kind of, that's probably one where it's quite difficult to see the obvious parallels in that the whole thing seems to be taking place in this kind of disconnected universe, I guess. But then you definitely, the woman behind the radiator does have like, you know, fairy vibes.
And he's called it his most spiritual film.
I mean, there's a rejection of domesticity in both. There's a sort of... Anyway, we cannot do this. We cannot do an extra essay on where we think that David Lynch and the Wizard of Oz crossover. Yeah, after 2 hours of it, I must say, I simply refuse. But so let's get some scores on this before we move on to film club. Hannah, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I think it's probably threes across the board. It's not one that I will kind of revisit, but I think for anyone who's really like into Lynch, it's a good kind of a curio, you know. It is nice to see the clips and to kind of see them in this context. I liked, there's like a split screen thing that they do quite a lot where you can see the footage from The Wizard of Oz with the footage from the David Lynch films. And I enjoyed that quite a lot. I do think Amy Nicholson's is very weird because she just brings up A Wonderful Life. And then there's like a whole thing about It's a Wonderful Life. And I was like, okay, I guess that's my little, just what? There was a lot of me kind of just thinking like, I wish I got this opportunity to just kind of make this video essay about just something that I've clearly had on my mind and like wanted to get out there. You know, that's the vibe I had from this, but not like a taxing watch at all. I think it's a perfectly enjoyable film, and it is like, it's nice. I mean, I think I find it quite satisfying as a viewer to go, when I'm rewatching my favorite directors, to find those kind of like recurring motifs or cinematic allusions. I always find those little kind of, now we call them Easter eggs, of course, but I always find those things fun about movie making. So yeah, no, perfectly fine little documentary. We've got some really good poster quotes for this one, haven't we?
God. I mean, I have to say the moment that I found most amusing was the Amy Nicholson one, because at one point she points out that the wind sound in The Wizard of Oz isn't actually wind sound. It's a load of people going, woo, if you listen very carefully.
I did enjoy
and
that.
I immediately did want to go watch it. David, what about you?
I'd probably say, yeah, similar take. I'd say it's a 3-3-2. It's interesting enough, but I think I'd probably would have rather listened to it as like, you know, seen it as like six little podcasts, a little video essay series online, rather than one big hulking thing. It was just too much in the end.
Yeah, I do feel like probably Little White Lies readership or listenership and David Lynch fandom as a Venn diagram is a circle. So we are probably the target audience for this. But yeah, I'm sort of around the same 3-3-2 vibe, which is a shame because obviously it's a fascinating subject matter from one of our most mysterious filmmakers. Next up, Film Club.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out UnitedHealthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The Muppet characters tell their version of the classic tale of Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol. Ebenezer Scrooge, an old miser who dislikes Christmas, is visited by spirits who foretell his future and share secrets from his past and present, which helps change his view on life. So, David, I've watched this approximately 1,000 times. I believe, though, this is your first time watching Muppet's Christmas Carol?
Yeah. It's interesting, actually, because, like, I have a young daughter who's 4. And we went to the Prince Charles Cinema recently and they had trailers for Muppet Christmas Carol, which they're showing as part of the obligatory seasonal re-release. And we kind of had a conversation, would she like this? Do you think it would be too much for her? Like, she's not massively, you know, into live action films at this point. Only one that she's really liked is Lyle Lyle Crocodile, which we waxed lyrical about a few weeks back. So this was actually when we were sort of we had our little conversation about who's going to go on each pod. When I saw that you were doing Muppets Christmas Carol, I was like, oh, perfect. This is the opportunity for me to do a kind of like a cine recce, if you will, and sort of watch it and see if I thought it would be worthwhile to take her. The answer I have actually is twofold is that the first thing I'll say is, like, obviously it's very good. Secondly, I would say I'm not quite sure that it would land with her because it's actually a little bit, firstly, it's a bit more of a sedate film than I was expecting. It doesn't have the kind of madcap comic, you know, Muppet antics you get from all the kind of earlier films. And it's really taken the source material, the Dickens source material, very seriously. And it kind of it plays a lot of it with quite a straight bat, even though it's kind of presented in its kind of unique Muppets way with songs. And there's actually a lot of it that I think that she might find a bit boring because it's actually dealing with like real issues and real social issues and about like a character who is learning the error of his ways. That character is obviously Ebenezer Scrooge as played by Michael Caine, and he really, you know, that performance has really got to be a kind of, I mean, it's hard to judge it against much, but it seems to me that it must be some kind of benchmark for like human puppet interaction acting. The way that he gives his Muppet co-stars, he's dealing with them in the most kind of empathetic and humane way imaginable, and you know, that he sees them, you know, as they are presented, as the makers hope we would, he kind of sees them as real living beings and interacts with them as such, and it just kind of lifts everything. And I get, and it's weird because you maybe think from the outset, oh, it's Michael Caine, you know, he did Jaws the Return instead of going to pick up his Oscar, and he's, you know, he was always about like, how much am I getting for this? And do I get to go to like Barbados to shoot the film? And yeah, this, and as such, he, you know, his CV is peppered with these kind of like cash in, you know, I need to retile the swimming pool movies. And this one, you maybe think from the outset, oh God, here we go. Another Caine needing a bit of extra pocket money. But no, this feels like, you know, this is one of his kind of actory, examples of him being a great actor. So yeah, bravo.
Yeah, there's something about how committed he is that kind of suggest that he really is putting his all into this committed performance. It doesn't and feel like he's half-assing it at all.
Committed and sober.
Yeah. Which, I mean, when you think of what the actual experience of acting on that set must have been like, because the number of bodies that there must just be lying out of shot puppeting these things, it's a kind of miracle that he didn't go mad. Because you imagine spending 3 months or so, which I guess is what I'd expect this took to shoot, with kudos to Michael Caine, although I have been actively supporting this film since I was about 7, so, and watching it every Christmas. So, you know, I at least have been acknowledging his fine work in this. Hannah, what about you? Is this one of your kind of Christmas ritual films, or were you a newbie as well?
No, not a newbie at all. Again, yeah, this came out, when was it? Early 90s? So, yeah, this was like a hardcore part of my childhood as well, and my whole family are like Muppet people. We love the Muppets, so I think this is definitely the best of the Muppet movies, I would dare to say. I think, I mean, in terms of David talking about introducing children to it, I think that Muppet Treasure Island is probably less po-faced. It's more zany, so I think kids might get along with that a little bit better. But this is just such a joy. I mean, it's a very good introduction to the work of Charles Dickens. We have Gonzo narrating it as Charles Dickens with some assistance from Rizzo the Rat, which is just such a, like, I really enjoyed their kind of occasional asides. They kind of pop in and out, a bit like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, just kind of like pop up to like kind of move the story along. But yeah, I mean, it's a difficult film to hate. I don't think I would trust anyone who doesn't like this film, because it's just a Christmas Carol, but there's Muppets. Like, that is, you know, it's already a really great story about greed and about why socialism is something we should be striving towards as a society. But you then add Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy and Animal, and suddenly, like, you know, it just makes you smile. And it's funny because, you know, talking about white noise and like kind of depressing, you know, end of the world and everything, I think this is a real kind of like tonic. And yeah, I do think Michael Caine's performance is just such a joy to watch, because he's just so invested in it. He is as invested here as he is in Get Carter or Alfie. You know, he's like committed. He's earning that paycheck. He came to set and was like, say no more, guys. The Muppets are real. I am going to treat Kermit and Miss Piggy and Stadler and Waldorf with the reverence and respect that they deserve as my colleagues. And I, you know, like, I think we just need a bit more of that today. I think we need a bit more professionalism when it comes to Muppets. And it did make me feel like, I was like, man, it just made me realize kind of how disappointing the modern Muppets films are. Like, and I liked them. I think that the most recent ones were fine, but this one is just, yeah, everything about it is just such a kind of pleasurable experience, even though it's not kind of this like zany goofball terrain, which I think that people usually kind of expect the Muppets to operate in. It's just such a kind of a charming film. And I really ride for the songs in it as well. David and I had a disagreement about this because he doesn't think the songs in it are that good. But I think that the songs in it I think that all but the last song, which I think is quite naff, but like the Ebenezer Scrooge song and One More Sleep Till Christmas are like all-time songs. Great, great, great stuff in there.
The Marley and Marley one absolutely slaps.
Whoa, 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 whoa. As a repeat offender, Layla, so when Kate, my wife and I watched the film last night, and we both agreed that, like, after a few decent songs, and it's John Williams, after a few good ones it gets quite maudlin, and I know that kind of I wouldn't necessarily that's like has a negative impact on the film, because it's quite, you know, the subject matter is quite serious and it's trying to reflect that, but just the songs themselves are a bit dull and a bit the lyrics aren't great, and I don't know, like the one about Tiny Tim was a low point for us.
Yeah, no, what, I will accept thought? That the one about Tiny Tim is we're getting a little overly sentimental. And I think yes. actually the sentimentality is the issue with some of the more recent Muppet fare, because it's so kind of tied up in nostalgia for the Muppets. Whilst I was just watching it every Friday night, because they had a wonderful show called The New Muppet Show, that was kind of supposed to be like a late night show, a parody of that. And I would watch that as a child and absolutely loved it. But yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that this is an introduction to Dickens, because this was my introduction to Dickens. And I don't know that I've seen a better adaptation of A Christmas Carol since.
Oh, no, I don't think there has been one. And there hasn't been one, certainly, that features. I just Googled these lyrics because I was laughing at them earlier. In the song where they're introducing Scrooge, there's this like amazing song where all the locals are singing about what a wrong-in Scrooge is. And there's this bit where they say, "He charges folk a fortune for his dark and drafty houses, as poor folk live in misery." And then these little mice appear and they go, "It's even worse for mice." It just made me laugh so much. And then they repeat it later, where like later in the song, they're talking about, you know, how awful he is to work with, and they say, "Don't ask him for a favor, because his nastiness increases. No crust of bread for those in need, no cheeses for his mises." And I just, like, you know, John Williams, whoever it was that was doing the lyrics for these songs, like, really was on one that day. Like, that's just incredible rhyming work. And I mean the listeners are probably think I'm insane, but you know, it just really is like the reason for the season in my eyes. It makes you
sorry,
happy.
it's Paul Williams.
Oh, Paul
it's
Williams.
Paul Williams, not John Williams. Sorry, I've got that wrong. It's Paul.
I just think I was like, John Williams didn't.
So one thing I was going to say from watching this film is, like, and just responding to what you say about, like, there hasn't been a better adaptation since, is I wonder, would there be scope for, like, a kind of, like, Guillermo del Toro's A Christmas Carol, where all the ghosts are, like, you know, it's a real, like, gothic version of it, where, like, the ghosts are covered in blood, and it's you know, and like, the Tiny Tim, like, Bob Cratchit's house is, like, it's a hovel, and Tiny Tim is kind of desiccating, and, you know, like, I wonder if there's some sort of, like, horror version of the film that's really kind of, like, because it's quite a despairing, potentially quite scary story. But from my experience, from, like, the Alistair Sims version, which I've seen, and this one, it's often played for kind of jolly laughs.
And this bit does have a whole section where they're talking about picking out a grave for Tiny Tim.
Yeah.
Well, mostly
children with leprosy. I don't know. I slightly wince at the thought of anything getting another gritty remake. So as much as I love Guillermo del Toro, I don't know that I need that.
I think a better question is, and it's a question that many people have asked before on the internet, but I would like to put it to you two. If you had to pick a book or a film to be a Muppets version, where, you know, you have a cast of Muppets and just one human actor, what would you go for?
Gosford Park and bring back Clive Owen.
Wow. You said that so quickly that I'm worried that's been on your mind.
No, I genuinely, it did just come to me.
I would pay so much money to see that. I mean, just from this year, I would definitely watch a Banshees of Inisherin remake, where Colin Farrell is the only human, and, you know, we have, like, Stadler Waldorf as Colm, and Miss Piggy would play Colin's sister. I think Colin Farrell, and I tweeted about this earlier, but I think he has something of a Muppet sensibility about him and would really commit to it in the same way Michael Caine does.
He would, yeah. I can't think of a book, but just you saying Gosford Park makes me think that, like, Nashville is basically a Muppet movie with people in it. So it's like the reverse sweep.
Oh my God, it is.
Would you just have one?
That blew
one
my mind
Muppet
so much
that.
More than anything from the Lynch Oz film. Yeah. This is what we need to do. We need to make a series of essays for Little White Lies' YouTube.
Muppets What Ifs.
Yeah, and David, yours will be why Nashville is secretly a Muppet film. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, it's Double Trouble in the Silent Twins, Guillermo del Toro's adaptation of Pinocchio, and for Film Club, more twins are up to no good, the film noir The Dark Mirror. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Lateef, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Hannah Strong. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stanks.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.